It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Last year, Wisconsin and 16 other states joined a Federal Trade Commission lawsuit against Amazon. The suit alleges that Amazon has abused its dominance as an online retailer and engaged in monopolistic business practices. The lawsuit, which is ongoing, has unsealed some of the company's records, giving the public a better look at how Amazon has been operating. One thing we still don't know exactly how Amazon makes its money. Our next guest says the answer to that question will play a big role in how this antitrust case against Amazon plays out. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of Amazon? Do you find it affordable and convenient to buy stuff? Do you worry it's getting too big? Do you want to support small businesses only to find you have to go through Amazon anyway? Do you encounter Amazon as a vendor? Do you sell stuff via Amazon? Have you seen fees creeping up over the years? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Stacey Mitchell is co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, a research and advocacy organization that supports locally driven economies. Her research on monopoly practices at Amazon has been cited by Congress and used to inform the FTC ongoing antitrust lawsuit against the company. Stacey, thanks a lot for joining us today.
So nice to be here. Thank you.
Can you tell us a little more about this Federal Trade Commission and multi-state lawsuit against Amazon? What are some of the key features of what they're digging into here?
Well, this is a case about Amazon's monopolization of the online market. The case argues that Amazon has dominance online, that the company captures a huge share of online shopping search. So when people go online to search for things, they often start right on Amazon. And as a result, lots of small businesses, medium-sized businesses, large businesses, basically any company that makes or sells a consumer product and wants to reach the online market essentially has to sell on Amazon. And the FTC alleges that Amazon uses that power and essentially locks in those sellers in ways that prevent them from selling effectively on other sites, and thus prevents the opening up of lots of competition online, and says that this hurts both businesses and consumers and effectively raises prices on all of us.
And Stacey, that's a key, as I understand it, to any antitrust suit. It's not just the bigness in and of itself of a company or its market dominance, but what it does with that market dominance, and if that is in some way unfair to trade. Is that really at the center of a case like this?
Yes, that's right. It's not illegal necessarily to be a monopoly, but it is illegal to use tactics to maintain that monopoly, to prevent competition from coming along. And that's what the government alleges that Amazon has been doing.
And to figure out exactly what Amazon is doing, you wrote in a recent piece, it's important to know how different divisions of Amazon are making their money, how much money they're making, and that's a little opaque, it sounds like, even after some documents came out as part of this lawsuit. Why is this such a tricky thing to figure out?
Well, strange as it may seem, we have no idea how Amazon makes profits and the scale of those profits for different parts of its business. Even though the company's been around for 30 years now, publishes a certain amount of financial information, it has very effectively kept secret the profitability of different divisions. So Amazon has, for a long time kind of cultivated this idea that it makes very little profit on its e-commerce platform, and that almost all of its profits come from AWS, its cloud division. But the FTC alleges that Amazon's online seller marketplace, its e-commerce platform, in fact, is, quote, enormously profitable, and says that this huge profits that Amazon is making on the site are evidence of its market power, that if there were competition, that those profit margins would naturally come down because there would be other companies coming into the market. And essentially what this hinges on is that Amazon, that the FTC says that Amazon, it has a lock on all of these sellers who essentially have to sell through its platform. And over the years, it's been steadily raising the fees that it charges those sellers. 10 years ago, Amazon's cut for a sale made by a third-party seller. If you sold $100 worth of stuff, you gave Amazon $14 in fees. Today, that has risen to a 50% cut, meaning one out of every $2 that sellers are making in revenue off Amazon's site, they are handing right back to Amazon in fees. And the FTC says that Amazon's margin on those fees are enormous, and that is a sort of key factor in the case that they've brought against the company.
Talking to Stacy Mitchell from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, looking at Amazon, big federal lawsuit. Wisconsin, as a state, joined in that lawsuit against Amazon for alleged monopolistic practices. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, maybe your experiences as a consumer or vendor who sells via Amazon. Have you felt the impact of those rising fees? Do you want to get out? But they keep pulling you back in. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Stacy, let's stay with that third-party vendor now. So say, and this is a big part of what you buy at Amazon. It's not buying it from Amazon itself, but from somebody. So say I'm one of these third-party vendors. I'm selling stuff on Amazon. I see these fees keep creeping up over the years. So I might want to go and sell on another platform, my own website or something like that. What is stopping me from doing that?
Amazon uses two primary tactics to stop you from doing that. The first is that Amazon has a pricing policy that essentially says that as a seller, you can't offer lower prices on other sites without being penalized on Amazon. And so if you think about it as a seller, you know, as you noted, your natural tendency would be like, gosh, Amazon's charging these exorbitant fees. I can barely survive over here, if at all. And I have to keep raising my prices in order to on Amazon in order to absorb all those fees. So why don't I go to another third party site, you know, another e-commerce platform, and sell my products there, maybe a platform that has lower fees, or on my own site where I don't have to charge those, where I'm not paying those fees. But what Amazon says is if their bots that, you know, crawl the web detect that you have a lower price on another site, they penalize you. They drop you to the bottom of the search results. They remove the buy box. And suddenly your Amazon sales vanish. And because Amazon is such a big share of the business of most sellers, they can't risk that. So what sellers do is when Amazon raises its fees, the sellers absorb those fees by charging elevated prices across the web. So they raise prices everywhere. And this is how consumers are effectively paying more. Whether you're shopping on Amazon or not, you are paying more because of those high fees. And effectively what happens is that, you know, instead of sellers being able to offer low prices on other sites, which would draw consumers and help to create more competition, Amazon maintains a lock on the market. And that set of tactics, the FTC says, is absolutely illegal, that it's a way to monopolize the market. And this case is designed to put a stop to it.
And that sounds like this would affect consumers and those higher prices you were talking about. But at the same time, it would be pretty much completely invisible to consumers, right? They would just see the same price wherever they tried to buy this stuff, Amazon or elsewhere, and think that's just the price.
Exactly. So what you have is you know, this is not competition. This is not a healthy market because, you know, Amazon's exorbitant fees on sellers, you know, those would naturally, there'd be a downward pressure on those because in a healthy market, sellers would go elsewhere. They would offer lower prices on those sites that offered lower fees to them. They'd pass that on to consumers, and consumers would be like, hey, I can get this for less on this other site. And they would start to migrate, and that would force Amazon to cut its fees. I mean, that's the natural kind of price competition that we should see, but we're not in fact seeing that online. And that really gets to the heart of this case. But the other important piece of it is that, you know, it's not just about the harm that this does to us as consumers, but it's also about the fact that all of these small and large companies across the economy are really being stifled by this. You know, there's a reason that you know, so many small businesses are failing, finding that they can't succeed online because of Amazon's high fees. They're being essentially blocked from the online market, which of course is a growing part of how consumers are shopping. And so they are being locked out, going under, laying off people, a drag on their communities. And meanwhile, when you shop on Amazon now, you know, you see a lot of kind of, you know, fly-by-night sellers based overseas. I mean, there's just a lot of sort of junk and chaos on Amazon. And that's because a lot of legitimate, hardworking businesses actually can't succeed on the site because of Amazon's fees.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Gail is with us in Fish Creek. Gail, hi.
Hi. I don't shop Amazon. I think Amazon is horrible. It has been forever. It's done so bad for the consumer and for small businesses. It's been terrible. But what else I have a question about is whether or not in the future, does your guest see that maybe we might have another class action lawsuit? Because Amazon Cloud is going to be the chosen for processing all navigation information for cars. All the new electric cars coming out, they're all going to be designed, and all set. There's going to be secondary features that are also going to be collected. All this information is going to be on Amazon servers, and it's going to be all personal information of the people who own those cars.
Gail, thanks a lot for the call. I've seen arguments, Stacey, even before that, whatever happens with cars, that accusations that Amazon uses its consumer data in some cases to compete against its own vendors. If we know Rob's products are successful on Amazon, Amazon could use that data, have their own store brand of Rob's product, undercut Rob, and then make money selling that and crowd out their own person. How Amazon uses its data, is that part of this or other lawsuits, Stacey?
That is absolutely something that antitrust officials are looking at as an element in this case as well. You know, I think it really raises this deeper problem, which is that when you have a company that isn't just doing one thing, but is a conglomerate that interconnects multiple different businesses, whether it's the cloud services, the online marketplace, Amazon's own retail division, its logistics operation, which is now delivering more packages than the postal service. They're making big moves into finance and healthcare. And what we see here is, you know, essentially that Amazon has been able to use its monopoly power online, the data that it gets from that, the enormous stream of profits that it gets from that, and then to give itself a built-in advantage as it moves into all of these other markets. And so, you know, monopoly power has a way of enabling a company to build dominance in all kinds of adjacent industries. And I think that that's a real concern as we look at Amazon and at least part of what this antitrust case from the federal government is trying to get at.
Gail, thanks for the call. We're talking to Stacey Mitchell, co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, national expert on Amazon's alleged monopoly power. She's with us to talk about a Federal Trade Commission lawsuit against Amazon, what we're learning about how the company operates, because in part of that lawsuit, you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you buy stuff on Amazon? Do you sell stuff on Amazon? Have you noticed the experience getting worse for you on either end of it? The money side of things getting worse? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about Amazon and what we know about their business practices, how they make their money, whether they're using their market power at the expense of consumers and other businesses, including people who sell stuff via Amazon. Stacey Mitchell is with us from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you enjoy shopping at Amazon? Do you wish there were more options? Do you own a business that does some sales via Amazon, or have you steered clear of that? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to our callers. Luann is with us in Madison. Luann, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to tell about my experience. My ebook is
being given away by Amazon for free. And I learned that other ebooks are being given away free also. And of course, that provides content for the reader that Amazon sells.
And Luann, did you allow that to happen? Did you consent to that, or was this a surprise to you?
Well, there was a contract that said that Amazon could change the price that I was asking, and I unfortunately went along with that, but changed the price. I did not mean give away for free.
Luann, interesting. I haven't heard of that happening. I've heard some other unpleasant experiences from ebook sellers on Amazon. Stacey, have you seen anything like that?
Yes, this unfortunately is the case within the ebook market. You know, Amazon is about 90% of ebooks, so incredibly dominant. They're about 50% of all books sold, you know, online and offline, 50% of the book market. And so what we have seen is that authors are being squeezed. I mean, when you have, you know, only one intermediary company between, you know, dominant intermediary between authors and readers, you tend to see a situation where that intermediary can squeeze the income of authors. And in the ebook market, it's been, you know, particularly bad, where Amazon has really reduced the income of authors significantly. And, you know, raises, I think, some real concerns as well about, you know, the diversity of ideas and the diversity of books that are able to be published. Because when you've got, you know, one company that is essentially, you know, steering us to its bestsellers and its and the things that it wants to showcase, you know, you've got a narrowing of the range of books that people buy, and that leads publishers to organize themselves around what is it that Amazon is going to sell, and to say no to other types of books. It just reduces, you know, this reduction in marketplace diversity has all kinds of effects up the supply chain, including on incomes, but also on the range of authors that can successfully, you know, make a living publishing books.
Luann, thanks for sharing that with us. Tanya joins us now in Stevens Point. Tanya, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
So I noticed, my daughter pointed out to me that if you have an Amazon Prime membership, the prices on Amazon Prime for products are actually higher on some of the products than they are on if you don't have an Amazon Prime membership. So they're adding that shipping cost in there. Even though you have a membership, they're faking you out because they actually are adding extra money onto your every purchase. Not every purchase, but if you look at it, if you have you and a friend of yours or a family member that doesn't have Amazon Prime, do the search, you'll see.
Tanya, thanks for the call. I've heard this at least anecdotally, Stacey. I don't know if that's across the board. Do we see variations in the prices Amazon might offer in different circumstances, in this case, Prime members or not, for their prices?
There's been some reporting that shows that Amazon's algorithm that chooses, you know, which offer is shown in the buy box. So the buy box is when you're on an Amazon product page and it says, you know, add to cart or buy now, there is a particular seller that has been chosen automatically. Now, if you dig down deeper, you can elect to choose a different seller if you like, but there's a particular offer that Amazon has chosen. It might be an offer, you know, it might be its product, it might be a third-party seller's product. And the algorithm appears to favor sellers that, you know, products that are Prime eligible, meaning sellers that are using Amazon's logistics, its fulfillment, order fulfillment, and warehousing and shipping service. Sellers that subscribe to that are much more likely to be in the buy box. And the result of that is that, you know, some sellers that may be offering a lower cost, even including shipping, might be more buried in the results and not show up in that buy box. So I imagine that might be what the caller is experiencing. But it raises a kind of broader issue, which is, you know, Amazon, and this is very much part of the FTC's monopolization case, Amazon has built this enormous warehousing and shipping operation, and it compels sellers to use that. If you don't use that, you're not eligible for Prime, and you're really, you're going to have much, much lower sales on Amazon as a result, because it prioritizes Prime products. But you know, for many sellers, they are not getting the lowest shipping costs through Amazon. They might prefer to use another option, but they're unable to. And because they have all of their inventory tied up in Amazon's warehouses, the FTC alleges that that's one additional way in which sellers are then kind of impeded from being able to build their sales on other sites. This is another way Amazon essentially uses its logistics to kind of lock them in and prevent competition from other e-commerce platforms.
In our last minute and a half or so, Stacey, what is the remedy being sought in this lawsuit? A lot of times when you think of a monopoly lawsuit, you think, oh, is it going to break it up into component parts? Mm-hmm. Not always. What are the outcomes that the FTC and others are looking for here?
Well, at this stage, the FTC has said, we want this case to go to trial. We want the judge to determine whether Amazon broke the law. And then we want to, the second phase is coming back and the FTC laying out then what it thinks the judge should do about, you know, any law violations that it finds. So the FTC has not been very detailed at this stage about what it's seeking, though it has said that it is seeking, you know, all manner of relief, including structural remedies, which, you know, refers to the idea that potentially what needs to happen here is that Amazon does need to be broken up into several companies in order to remove the kinds of conflicts of interest that have given rise to its kind of grip on the e-commerce market and open up the market to competition. We haven't seen breakups much in recent decades through antitrust lawsuits, but they used to be more common. And there's good evidence that, you know, this would not make Amazon go away, but it would Amazon would continue to be part of the market, but they would, you know, effectively have to compete on the merits, and we would see more competition as a result. And there's a lot of history of these cases that show that those kinds of breakups are actually can be very beneficial and lead to new innovations as well as benefits from both consumers and other businesses.
Stacey, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Stacey Mitchell, co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, a group that supports locally driven economies. We've been talking about the latest antitrust lawsuit against Amazon, what it could mean for the future of the company and consumers. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. It's been just over 6 months of war in Gaza after Hamas attacked Israel on October 7th of last year. Last week, following Israeli military attacks that killed humanitarian aid workers from World Central Kitchen, President Biden had a phone call with Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. For the first time since October, President Biden apparently showed a willingness to condition continued support for Israel on how Netanyahu and the country's military act. That includes an effort to minimize killing Palestinian civilians and to allow more aid to safely reach them. After the call, Israel did announce some additional aid routes. We're going to talk about how the U.S. position toward Israel has evolved since October, how America's influence is being felt by the prime minister there, and how it could all affect the future of the conflict. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions, what thoughts do you have about U.S. foreign policy? When it comes to Israel, what do you want to see from the Biden administration here? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Guy Ziff is an associate professor in the School of International Services Department of Foreign Policy and Global Security at American University, where he's associate director of the Meltzer Schwarzburg Center for Israel Studies. His books include Readings in U.S. Foreign Policy and his latest, Netanyahu versus the Generals, The Battle for Israel's Future. Guy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me back.
I want to start off with a listen to U.S. National Security Communications Advisor John Kirby speaking last Thursday at a White House briefing after that call I mentioned between Biden and Netanyahu.
On that phone call, the president emphasized that the strikes on humanitarian workers and the overall humanitarian situation in Gaza are unacceptable. He made clear the need for Israel to announce and to implement a series of specific, concrete, and measurable steps to address civilian harm, humanitarian suffering, and the safety of aid workers. He made clear that U.S. policy with respect to Gaza will be determined by our assessment of Israel's immediate action on these steps. He underscored that an immediate ceasefire is essential to stabilize and improve the humanitarian situation and to protect innocent civilians. And he urged the Prime Minister to empower his negotiators to conclude a deal without delay to bring the hostages home.
A lot there. Guy, what do you make of at least what the White House is saying about this phone call and whether it's a change in the U.S. attitude toward Israel?
I don't see this so much as a change of U.S. attitude, and certainly not President Biden's attitude, but I think that President Biden has grown increasingly frustrated with Benjamin Netanyahu, the longest-serving Israeli prime minister, and clearly increasing the amount of humanitarian aid and expediting the delivery of this aid is a top priority for the administration. There are so many challenges when it comes to aid delivery. It has to be delivered through the various Israeli security checkpoints for inspection. There are all sorts of bottlenecks with the distribution of this aid once it's in the Gaza Strip. There are efforts to prevent Hamas from seizing some of this aid, which it's done on numerous occasions in the past. And of course, the roads in Gaza are in awful condition as a result of this war. And these are the challenges with which the U.S. Must contend when it's pushing Israel to increase the amount and the expediting delivery of this aid.
The U.S., as you mentioned, hasn't really changed position all that much, mostly supportive of Israel. Military aid still goes to Israel. There have been some calls in the U.S. and elsewhere to say, hey, let's condition some of that aid on concrete improvements in humanitarian measures. Are we at that point yet? Is that something you see as being likely?
I see this as a growing trend among progressives within the Democratic Party who are frustrated with President Biden's overall support for Israel and for clearly stating that he was on Israel's side during this war. Even though, as I mentioned, he is growing frustrated with Prime Minister Netanyahu. I don't see this happening in the immediate future under President Biden. There may be some steps that he will take if Netanyahu defies him, for example, if he decides to go ahead and invade Rafah in the southern part of Gaza, despite Biden's clearly stated opposition to an Israeli ground invasion there. So it's possible. It's possible that he might delay aid. It's possible that he might even go further and prevent certain offensive weapons from being delivered to Israel in the future. This is something that Democrats, or some of them at least, want to see happen. But I think it's enough to threaten to do so, and it's enough to kind of have this dialogue, some of which has spilled into the open with Israelis, and I'm talking about tough love here, that may be sufficient in getting Netanyahu to do what the administration feels needs to be done. So, for example, this week, we have already seen the highest number of aid trucks entering Gaza since the start of the war. There were 419 trucks on Monday, 322 trucks on Sunday. This is far, far greater number than anything we've seen up to this point. And you can say that that's a direct result of the pressure that the Biden administration has put on Israel. Israel has also agreed to open another border crossing into Gaza from the north to allow more aid to enter through that area. Israel has agreed to more maritime aid deliveries through its port in Ashdod, and also has agreed to expand aid through Jordan. So we're seeing progress here on the humanitarian front for sure.
Talking to Guy Ziv from American University, author of the recent book Netanyahu versus the Generals, The Battle for Israel's Future, looking at Israel, Gaza, and American foreign policy as it relates to the conflict there. You could join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Guy, I want to turn from U.S. policy toward Israel to Israeli internal politics. Now, you were just putting the finishing touches on this book when the October 7th attack happened. You were able to get a little bit in the afterword about that. But you saw concerns about Israeli security based on the relationship between Prime Minister Netanyahu and security officials, military officials in Israel. What were some of the concerns you were seeing before October of last year?
Well, what motivated me to write this book was what I saw as a fascinating paradox. Netanyahu, who has throughout his entire career cultivated this image as Mr. Security and was seen by a large percentage of Israelis as the kind of the one person in Israel who they can trust to secure the country. And on the other hand, there has been unprecedented tensions between Netanyahu and the security establishment, which did not begin with October 7th. In fact, I trace it to the very first days of his premiership, first term as prime minister in 1996. So to me, this was kind of a very interesting, very fascinating puzzle and paradox that I wanted to explore. And I submitted my final proofs on October 6th.
Wow.
And then after October 7th, I had to, of course, ask my publisher, who readily agreed to enable me to write that afterward.
We're seeing now protests within Israel, in part, many of the protesters putting blame on Netanyahu for security lapses leading to the attack, also demands to bring hostages home sooner. As you look at what's happening in Israel literally this week, what do you make of these protests and Netanyahu's position now?
I think October 7th and everything we've seen since October 7th have really shattered this myth that Netanyahu is actually Mr. Security. I mean, October 7th was the single greatest terrorist incident in Israel and in the history of the country, and the single greatest anti-Semitic event since the Holocaust. So this all happens under Netanyahu's watch. And I think that this finally kind of shattered that myth. And even many of his own voters have turned against him. And poll after poll shows very consistently that the majority of Israelis want early elections and they want to replace him. If there were elections held today, there's no way he'd be able to form a coalition government. What's also driving some of the animus towards him, both on the part of the security establishment figures, but also in the general public, is this notion that Netanyahu is putting his own personal and political interests ahead of national security interests, that by prolonging the war and by minimizing opportunities for a hostage deal, he is essentially enabling himself to stay in power so long as this war continues.
And that fits the theme of much of your book. That perception was there before October that Netanyahu was interested in his own politics, his own personal gain versus security. This that accusation now isn't surprising to you, I'm guessing.
Not at all. I think that, and that's really the difference here. So the security establishment has felt this way for quite some time. Of course, active officers and generals and security personnel are not allowed to talk politics, but once they retire from politics, they're certainly open to say anything and everything on their minds. And the overwhelming majority of retired heads of the Mossad, the Shin Bet, former generals, former IDF chiefs of staff, have all pretty much the vast majority of them have come out against Netanyahu politically and personally.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Eau Claire. Chris, hi.
Hi. Well, I appreciate the question presented in respect to Biden and our approach to foreign policy.
I wonder what your thoughts are on the Arab nations' response to this, whether it's Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, Qatar, Turkey, and the like, seem to have taken a very, they seem to have fallen back, at least the governments have, as far as how they perceive this. Do you feel that perhaps they're willing to see groups like Hamas and Hezbollah get their nose bloodied a bit? Where do you see their role in this conflict?
Interesting question, Chris. Guy.
Good question, and I think the caller, you know, just hit the nose on its head. Basically, the idea here hit the nail on its head. Excuse me. The idea here is that there is a clear preference among many of these leaders who have made all sorts of diplomatic overtures towards Israel in recent years to deal a fatal blow to Hamas, which they see as threatening to the stability of the region. Groups like Hamas and Islamic Jihad and in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, groups like Hezbollah in Lebanon. But they have to also consider and weigh the notion that the public opinion is not with them when it comes to Israel. That most Arabs, most whether it's Saudis or Egyptians or Jordanians, are not in favor of normalization with Israel, even though Egypt and Israel, for example, have had a peace treaty since the late 70s. But this is something that the Arab leaders have to really kind of walk that fine line. We have not seen them abrogate the Abraham Accords or any of the other treaties or agreements. We have seen a few of them recall ambassadors, but I think that's done more for public display as opposed to any sort of meaningful change. So privately, I think that they are on Israel's side, you could say. Publicly, they have to be a lot more careful about how they weigh their words.
Chris, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking about the ongoing war in Gaza. Some added pressure President Biden is putting on Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu to address dire humanitarian concerns while pursuing its goal of eliminating Hamas. Guy Ziv stays with us, associate professor and foreign policy expert at American University. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you want to see all of this resolved? Do you have hopes that something can come out of this, a lasting peace? If so, what would it take to get there? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Guy Ziv, associate professor in the School of International Services, Department of Foreign Policy and Global Security at American University, talking about the ongoing war in Gaza, efforts to reach a ceasefire deal, new pressure from President Biden and Prime Minister Netanyahu. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your questions, your thoughts. Let's go. Oh, we had a caller who just dropped. Bob in Menominee says Israel should have used more special enforces instead of this wider scale attack. Worries about the impact on civilians. Was there, Guy, if assuming Israel had a goal of hampering or eliminating Hamas after that October 7th attack, was there a way to do that more of a special forces, I guess, surgical attack, as I think Bob was hoping?
I think some of those kind of smart weapons were not in Israel's hands. Also, Israel has learned a lot in the last half a year about strategy and tactics and Hamas's own plans, as much of which was discovered during the initial operations. Definitely a greater attempt now with more insight, and one can add more pressure for Israel to make these this is a different phase of the war. We're not seeing the same number of troops in Gaza. We're not seeing the same number of forces there. And we're also seeing much more targeted operations. So, for example, just today, there were Israel assassinated three of the Hamas chief's sons. So we're seeing much more targeted operations that are more surgical and precise in nature, that can avoid the kind of major civilian loss, civilian casualties that we saw in the early phase of the war.
Let's bring on another caller. Chris is with us in Milwaukee. Chris, hi.
Hi. I guess my ears really pricked up when the professor mentioned that this was the largest anti-Semitic attack on Jewish people since the Holocaust. I think that anti-Semitism has been being used as kind of a tool to criticize people who are just basically saying we want our land. Palestinian people have been kicked out of where they lived, and their reason that they are in some sort of struggle isn't because they hate Jewish people, it's because they don't live in their houses anymore. And I think the professor's using that kind of slyly to paint people as racist, as a lot of people do these days.
Chris, thanks for the call. Guy, what do you think?
Well, I would certainly make a distinction between criticism of Israel, which is 100% legitimate, and describing objectively what happened on October 7th. And on October 7th, we saw mass violence against Israeli civilians, not only Israeli civilians, but these are people who were living quietly and peacefully in the communities in the southern part of Israel that border the Gaza Strip. Many of them were actually human rights activists opposed to the Israeli occupation. There were a lot of peace activists among those who were murdered and taken hostage, some of them prominent activists, including those who spent a good chunk of their free time bringing sick Gazans into Israel so they could go to Israeli hospitals, volunteering their time on all sorts of peace-related and humanitarian missions. These are the people who were killed, raped, and massacred. And so this is a very objective description of what happened on October 7th. The numbers alone, even without the descriptive part, attest to the largest single anti-Semitic incident since the Holocaust. We haven't seen anything else like it. And by the way, the UN report that was released just last month confirms an aspect of October 7th that had been widely dismissed or even denied in some sectors. And I'm referring here to Hamas fighters raping women and even corpses during the October 7th massacre and beyond. And we're not talking about a couple of isolated cases here, but rather Hamas's systematic weaponization of sexual violence.
Thanks again for the call, Chris. Guy, I want to take our last few minutes. Before October 7th, we had, I think it's fair to say, a pretty unsustainable status quo between Israel and Gaza and the West Bank, for that matter. And now, after October 7th, after the 6 months of conflict, do you see a road to something better than we had before, some more stable and hopefully peaceful resolution?
It's very, very, very difficult to express any sort of optimism at a time when people are suffering, when there are so many casualties, so many deaths, so many destroyed communities in Gaza and in parts of Israel. What I will say is that some of the tragedies in the past have paved the way for new ideas and even positive diplomatic developments. So, for example, if you look at the Yom Kippur War, the 1973 surprise attack war that occurred almost 50 days to the day of the October 7th Gaza Hamas massacre, we see that 4 years after the Yom Kippur War, Anwar Sadat, the Egyptian president who had launched that war, goes to Israel and addresses the Israeli people in the Knesset and calls for peace and followed through on that with the first Arab-Israeli peace treaty. We also saw that in the wake of the first Palestinian Intifada, we saw the Oslo Accords that gave at least temporary hope to Israelis and Palestinians for a better tomorrow when Israel and the PLO formalized these agreements on the front lawn of the White House. That was when Bill Clinton was president, first term. And so it's definitely possible that something positive will eventually emerge. What we need is we need to lower the temperature and we need to try to fight populist nationalists, those who are seeking to gain advantage by polarization, the politics of polarization. And what we really need are also leaders who can make some bold, even if they're unpopular, but bold steps for peace. President Biden, for example, has made it very clear that he is a supporter, not only a supporter of a two-state solution, as he's always been, but he is his administration's vision for the future is a two-state solution. We're not hearing this from either Hamas or from the Israeli leadership right now. But if we do have new leadership there, if we do see new leadership there, I think there's definitely some room for optimism, because at the end of the day, the Israelis aren't going anywhere. The Palestinians aren't going anywhere. They're going to have to figure out a way to live together.
Thanks to our guest, Guy Zib from American University. His latest book is called Netanyahu versus the Generals, The Battle for Israel's Future. Wisconsin has a lot of Hall of Fame members in various sports at the pro and college levels, but here's a first. Wisconsin's first member of the Santa Claus Hall of Fame. As reported in the Appleton Post-Crescent, first of all, there is an International Santa Claus Hall of Fame honoring people who do a great job of portraying Santa. Now Jeff McMullen of Appleton, a.k.a. Santa Mac, will join its ranks. He'll be honored and inducted at an event in 2 weeks. Part of the reason, he set up his own space for Santa visits without all the stress and hubbub of malls and other places, a calm background that can be adjusted to the needs of particular kids, plus it's wheelchair accessible, and he's trained other Santas along the way. I could use that the one time I filled in for Santa at a family gathering. The outfit was designed for uncles who were shorter and stouter than I was, and I didn't really have the voice for it either. So no Santa Hall of Fame for me. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to the author of a new book that follows the fight for women's financial freedom in the 20th century and beyond. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about high school students learning about journalism through a video game.
We live in a time when fake news permeates social media feeds and partisan coverage blasts through some cable news channels. Teaching media literacy can help people wade through the disinformation and become critical news consumers. As Christina Leffering tells us, a video game created by UW-Madison's Field Day Labs aims to teach students to become more media literate.
This is the sound of a room full of newbie reporters having a very rough day.
I was fired for assaulting a crane.
Why'd you do that?
Spray it with pepper spray or run.
Why would you get fired for that?
Because I had to go to court or something because it was very illegal.
To be clear, Marshfield High School student Angel O'Brien Weber was not fired, and no cranes were assaulted. She and her classmates are playing Headlines and High Water, a computer game where they guide Elle Benjamin through her day as a rookie reporter at the fictional Twin Lakes Gazette. The city has flooded on the day of the Cherry Festival, and Elle has a limited amount of time to report and turn in stories about the flood. Similar to Choose Your Own Adventure, students like Jesus Mireles decide whether she helps her neighbor catch her loose chickens.
I lured him with food. That's pretty smart, by the way.
Absolutely.
Where to go and who to talk to. In Sarah Sharma's case, she got stuck on the phone with the town busybody, Fred.
Time my stupid cats for 45 minutes.
The goal is for students to turn in stories.
Your story isn't going so well.
Stupid Fred.
Hopefully good stories. On time to her boss. Sarah Gagnon from Field Day Labs, the Madison-based company that created Headlines in High Water, says initially the journalists were given budgets.
All the journalists that we talked to immediately reacted, and they're like, we don't have money. We have time. Our currency is time.
Early decisions in the game affect outcomes later on. If Elle eats breakfast, she has more endurance. If she socializes, her interactions with people later on are more fruitful.
You need to have endurance if you have to stay up really late, or you have to have tech skills or you have to be able to earn people's trust.
Lindsay Whiting learned at least one valuable trick of the trade.
Food is the way to their hearts. If you bring them food, they'll tell you stuff.
But all students at some point run out of time.
Actually, one thing that has been really funny during all the testing with the kids is that it makes them so angry when people won't talk to them because they don't have enough trust, or they feel like it's very unfair when they run out of time. And I'm like, oh, I'm sure journalists feel that way too.
They also have to find the right balance between facts, anecdotes that add color, and pictures. Joe Nyman turned in a breaking news story that was all photos and is now working on an article on wetlands.
I don't think my entirely picture article would have flown for the science one because that one required more factual evidence, mm-hmm. which makes sense. Mm-hmm. Because if it's a science article, it should not just be pictures.
The bigger goal is to get young people to think about news and its quality beyond whether it's real or fake.
News isn't like perfect or fake. It's always going to be critiquable and something that we have to be questioning and engaging with.
Joe Nyman came away thinking about credibility and the quality of information.
Sometimes you have to fact check what other people say. So if someone says something and you're not quite sure about it, you have to go and check other people just to make sure that it's a good quality quote.
And hopefully it'll get some students to think about maybe becoming a journalist one day.
I don't like this
job. There's so many chickens in here.
I'm quitting.
But not Jesus.
I'm going back to farming. I don't like this job. I hate it.
Even if these students end up being farmers, teachers, or anything other than a journalist, hopefully they come away from this game understanding and appreciating the work journalists do. To not only get the story, but get the story right.
Christina Leffering brought us that story on the media literacy video game, Headlines and High Water. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Central Time. We may take it for granted that women have the right to participate in the U.S. economy as workers, consumers, business owners, and more. A lot of those rights came along pretty recently in the scope of American history. For one example, it's been just 50 years since the Equal Credit Opportunity Act took effect. Before that, a woman could be refused a credit card or other banking service because she was a woman. It took another 14 years to guarantee that women could get business loans without a male cosigner. In her new book, our next guest tracks the trajectory of women's financial freedom over the 20th century and where we stand today. Along the way, she introduces many of the women who fought for changes over the decades. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you remember when the Equal Credit Opportunity Act was passed yourself? Have you experienced gender discrimination as a job? How have pregnancy or access to childcare affected your career? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Josie Cox is a journalist who's written for Reuters, The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, and The Guardian. She's the author of the new book, Women, Money, Power, The Rise and Fall of Economic Equality. Josie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me on the program.
On the rise side of your book, Josie, you track many milestones for women in the financial world, in the business world, and more. A key point I took away from your book is none of those just sort of happened. There were women fighting for those changes every step of the way.
Absolutely, yeah. And that was the real motivation for me to actually sit down and write this book. I've been a journalist for about 15 years, mostly covering kind of financial markets, and always sort of, you know, wondered why the world of finance, the world of big money, as I characterize it, is still so male dominated. At the sort of highest echelons of business, we still see far more men than we see women. And so I sort of started delving into this topic, and I realized that the way to track, to sort of chronicle women's fight for financial freedom, as you put it, has to be through the women who fought for it, because their stories are so remarkable. And I often say that many of these women have been written out of history altogether, but perhaps it's even more accurate to say that they were never really written into history in the first place.
And that takes me to the first story you share in the book. Women worked in the United States before World War II, but the departure of a number of men to fight overseas brought a lot of women into an industrial workforce where they hadn't really been seen. And you talk to one of those women who made it her mission in the decades that followed to make sure that her story and the story of thousands and thousands of women wasn't lost. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the biggest challenges I faced when I decided to tackle this topic was where to begin, right? Because you could really go back all the way through history and try and find the origin story of how women started to fight for financial independence. But World War II seemed to be a good place to start because, as you say, that was a time when women really in considerable numbers started coming into the paid labor market, as I like to describe it, taking the jobs of these men who were off at war and really proving that they were just as capable, just as competent at doing these jobs that were previously, you know, very much the domain of men. And so, you know, as I said, my motivation was to tell the stories through these individual women. I was fortunate enough to manage to find one of these real life Rosie the Riveters, as I refer to her. Her name is May. She lives in Pennsylvania. And as a teenager, she actually built Boeing aircraft in Seattle. So imagine the thrill of that. Being a teenage girl, she came from North Dakota, and she started building aircraft and realizing that she had this this talent, this potential to actually quite literally and metaphorically roll up her sleeves and do these jobs, which up until that point had really been the jobs of her brothers and her father.
The war ended, the door slammed shut on her and so many other women. And then there was a long slog, one step at a time. What are a couple of the key milestones at the workplace that you see for women over the next few decades after World War II?
Yeah, it's a great question. So when I set out to write the book, I knew that access to reproductive rights would necessarily be a really important part of this narrative. I didn't quite appreciate how central reproductive rights, access to contraception has been historically for women. And you know, you can see sort of the labor charts, the charts showing female labor force participation over time. And there's a huge uptick, you know, in 1960, which was the year that the first contraceptive pill became widely available across the US. And so, you know, whenever I'm asked what is the most important development of the 20th century for female economic empowerment, unequivocally, I believe it is the introduction of the oral contraceptive pill. And the story behind that introduction is wild. One of the women I profile in the book is a lady named Catherine Dexter McCormick, mm-hmm. who essentially single-handedly provided all the financing into the research and development that went into developing this pill that allowed women ultimately to plan when they wanted to start having babies, when they wanted to start having a family, and ultimately would help them to be able to not just have jobs throughout their lives, but real careers.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Kristen is with us in Wausau. Kristen, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to comment on two things. One, that I've been working for, I had been a teacher, and then I left the teaching system and started working at the co-ops because I was taking care of my son after my divorce, and I was basically a woman in a man's world, and I was underpaid. I was promised a certain wage when I started, and then when I got my first paycheck, I was paid less. And when I drew it to their attention, they told me that was never the case, that they said agreed.
Oop.
And was driving there, and I was moved. I was told with everything that I did that I would get additional payment, you know, a higher rate. And they moved me up to trainer, and I trained all the new people. And at the point where everybody in the room when we had a meeting was hired after me, and everybody was paid more than me by about $3.
Kristen, thanks a lot for the call. Kristen, her line wasn't great there, Josie. And it ultimately, the men she was training were getting paid more than her for training them. This is a huge part of the story you tell, unequal treatment and unequal pay at the workplace.
Yeah. And, you know, as you said at the beginning of this segment, you know, we have come an awful long way. And, you know, it's been many years since women could legally get fired for being pregnant, for example, or could, you know, legally be paid a different amount of money for doing the same job as a man. But I think what we're hearing from Kristen and from probably many other listeners who are listening to the program today, there still are so many examples of discrimination as a result of bias, conscious bias or unconscious bias. And so the law, you know, while it has come a long way, is still very imperfect in so many ways. So this is a fight that is going to last for a very long time.
Thanks for the call, Kristen. Josie Cox is with us. We're talking about her new book, Women, Money, Power, The Rise and Fall of Economic Equality. It tells the story of the fight for women's financial freedom, equality at the workplace, and more over the last century or so. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a woman in a paid workplace, do you feel like people don't look at you the same? Do you not get paid the same? Do you not get respect? Do you not get the opportunity for advancement if you hold a leadership position at a place of work? Do you think your employees trust you more, less, or the same as male peers? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Josie Cox, journalist, author of the new book, Women, Money, Power, The Rise and Fall of Economic Equality. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Depending on how old you are, what is your perspective on women in the workplace? Do you feel like as a woman, you're just part of the team? Or do you feel like you're treated differently? Have you seen things change over the years, over the generations? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Josie, I want to take things to the present day now. You looked in one of your chapters at Silicon Valley, right? The cutting edge of the American economy. And there are surveys and a lot of anecdotes and more showing stuff that we might associate, you know, with the Mad Men era, 1950s type business when it comes to the treatment of women. What kind of things do we see there?
Yeah, so I decided to delve into Silicon Valley because, as you say, it is such a hot pot of sexism in many cases. We hear so many stories of misogyny, of bias, of discrimination, quite frankly. And it makes up such a huge part of our economy. It's a hugely important sector, so many very large corporations employing people. So in many cases, you know, it sort of sets the pace for behavior in the workplace. It sort of sets the pace for what's acceptable behavior, what's corporate culture that we should all be aspiring to abide by. And so I decided to delve into that. I think what we've seen in Silicon Valley is a lot of companies growing extremely quickly and being founded by teams of individuals who sort of attract each other because they're very similar in many ways. They share similar interests. They resemble each other. They're pretty homogenous, in other words. And the thing with companies that grow quickly is that often the HR function, so to speak, kind of lags the growth of the company. So rather than focusing on creating a really considered work environment where every employee is able to reach their full economic and professional potential, regardless of their gender or their race or their sexual orientation or whatever other characteristic it might be. The mantra in Silicon Valley is very much to grow as fast as possible, to create profits as fast as possible, because that's the pressure that the investors in those companies are putting the companies under. And so what we see as a result of that is a sort of hotbed of behavior that is problematic. Women who feel very marginalized by these particular corporate cultures. And I share, you know, a couple of really interesting examples of that and quite frankly, horrifying examples.
Let's go back to our callers. Vivian is with us in Green Bay. Vivian, hi.
Hi. 1963, I graduated from high school. My first job was with the regional utility company here. Their policy was that women quit when they married. And then in 64, of course, the Equal Rights Act, they couldn't do that anymore. But at one point, I divorced my husband, and I couldn't get any credit. That was in 1982 because I didn't have any credit history, of course. Mm-hmm. And I remarried in my 30s, and my new husband had children from a prior marriage, and of course I had mine, and I wanted not to have children, and he wanted not to have more children,
but my obstetrician gynecologist would not prescribe medication or perform any procedures because he didn't believe in that.
Vivian, thanks for the call. Josie, Vivian lived big, huge parts of the story you tell in your book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think what she's talking about is so important because, you know, we have to remember that despite the fact that laws came into effect that essentially should have enabled her to get credit, that should have enabled her to have access to birth control and to contraception, in practice and in reality, in many cases, it just took an awful long time for sort of the real life to catch up with the letter of the law.
Thanks for that call, Vivian. Samantha is with us now in Appleton. Samantha, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking me on the show. I had called because I have had like a myriad of different jobs throughout my life, starting from when I was a teenager. But eventually, I saw sexism and unequal pay throughout many of my jobs, especially working in the food industry. And then I was also a correctional officer for the state of Wisconsin prison system, whereas I would volunteer time and effort to provide training services to new individuals who would then surpass me in rank, or I would be passed up for job opportunities or team working opportunities simply because it was a male that would be then added on to those teams.
Samantha, thanks a lot for the call. Josie, there are a lot of laws now in place that would try to tackle discrimination that Samantha experienced. How hard is it in practice to apply those laws again in somebody like Samantha's instance?
Yeah, I think Samantha's example and the other examples that we've heard today as well are sort of illustrative of the fact that laws, as I say, are imperfect. And I actually characterize laws in the book as sort of a fishing net with very large holes. And the most egregious offenses, so, you know, firing a woman for getting pregnant, for example, those things would get caught in that fishing net. But everything else still tends to slip through. And I'm thinking of things like microaggressions. I'm thinking of things like hiring decisions that Samantha was just talking about. We know that there are biases that are very dominant in the way that workplaces are shaped. And those biases, for, you know, examples of those biases are that we as humans tend to trust people more who resemble us physically or who share some kind of common heritage with us or who went to the same school or who have the same skin color as of us, for example. And those biases in many workplaces are still going unchecked. And so, you know, it's going to take a very long time. And I think that we all collectively have a responsibility to inform ourselves about these biases, to check ourselves on these biases, and to also have many open conversations in workplaces and in communities and in the home about the impact that these biases can have.
Samantha, thanks for sharing your story. And Josie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Josie Cox, a journalist who's written for Reuters, The Wall Street Journal, and elsewhere. We've been talking about her new book. It's called Women, Money, Power, The Rise and Fall of Economic Equality. So time for you to share your stories. You can email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, birdwatching can be a great hobby and a way to get outside, and it can be an inspiration to be better stewards of the environment. That's according to the author of the new book, Birding to Change the World. And large numbers of young adults say they're not so wild about capitalism thanks in part to economic roadblocks in their lives and because of treatment at workplaces. We'll dig into younger workers and the capitalist economy. And if you are under 40 and feeling that way yourself, again, love to hear your story. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.